Well, it's with great pleasure that I am here to chair this first in our Migration, Ethnicity and Race seminar series. And we have seminar on Hidden and Revealed Attitudes to Immigration, a List Experiment, which is going to be presented by Francis McGinty from ESRI in Dublin and Matthew Creighton from University College Dublin. They both have extensive experience working on migration. Fran is an associate research professor at the ESRI, and she's an adjunct professor at Trinity College Dublin. And she's worked on a number of projects around migration and discrimination. And Matt is an associate professor at the University College Dublin with particular experience in migration as well as expertise on migration. And he also runs the European Social Survey, the island part of the European Social Survey. I don't want to take up the time they've got to speak, so without more ado, I'm going to hand you over to Matt and Fran to start.
Thanks very much, Lucinda. Yes, and greetings from Dublin. I'm not actually in the ESRI. Most people in Ireland are at home at the moment. As Lucinda mentioned, I work at the Economic and Social Research Institute and coordinate a research programme on human rights and equality, funded by the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission. And this study, the report we published in July, is part of this. I was very fortunate in this programme to have someone who'd done many List experiments in different countries. So I'm going to be presenting this jointly with Matt Creighton today, and I'll now hand over to Matt for the first part of the presentation.
So I'm Matt Creighton. I was lucky enough to be brought in to help with the technical side of this, but hopefully there's some substantive things I can say of interest. So Fran's going to be advancing the slides, so occasionally I'll say like, next. So like now, next. So basically the starting point for Fran and I was a kind of position of skepticism. And it was skepticism with the extent to which people are willing to express attitudes towards immigrants. And I've worked in other domains as well, because there can be a social cost to expressing intolerance in certain interactions. And it isn't so much an idea that people have some sort of inner, you know, truth of truth that they keep safe. It's just that people in different formats and different interactions tend to express themselves differently. And one way is when you're asking kind of direct questions about immigration, you sometimes find that people can try to be consistent with an expectation that you might have, whether you mean it or not. So can we look at the next slide? There's a lot on the particular area of immigration. There's a kind of growing and fairly large at this point a literature looking at either over or understatement of opinions, and that is there's a lot of ways that people interpret that. So I'm going to interpret it kind of as a sociologist would, but I'll go through the way other disciplines think about the way people might deceive you if they're talking about things that might have a social cost or stigma. You've seen it in nativism, attitudes about the closing the border in the U.S., immigration policy preferences more broadly. And you see a lot of variation in how people express it, depending on whether certain frames are emphasized or made more salient, whether people are talking about religion or religious attributes of an immigrant group. They're touching on race, national identity, and differences based on characteristics that you might not think are particularly important, because we often focus on the attributes of the immigrant group, but also varies significantly by the attributes of the respondent, to the extent either by political ideology and orientation or race and ethnicity. There was a couple studies in the US that looked at that. But it also bleeds over into other areas that should be of interest. There was some very good work, well, it's all good work, but there was good work that was done on attitudes towards including prevalence corrections for the experience of miscarriages and access to abortion services in a variety of contexts in which there was over and understatement depending on the assumption of what people might think about a particular response. So can we look at the next slide? Generally, in sociology, the root of this overstatement comes from a literature on stigma. And stigma is often, or really, if you think about the kind of Goffman style of stigma, it's about attributes that are judged by others, and some are discredited, meaning that you can't hide them in any given circumstance. And some of them actually are discreditable, meaning that one might, in a given interaction, not share them. And so for stigma to be something that people can meaningfully dodge by, let's say, not expressing themselves, you have to be able to anticipate that people have particular judgments about what you might say, and it has to be avoidable. So it's, in that case, you know, it's really a dangerous territory if you think about kind of surveys and even more nuanced and in-depth interaction, because it is easily avoidable and it can be anticipated. So you kind of have to wonder what you can do, and there's no perfect solution, but I'll go through what some disciplines have done. So let's move on. In economics, you see a lot of this in game theory. It's a very robust literature. It has a lot to do with incentivized deception. So kind of at what cost do people tell the truth or cease to tell the truth? Really good stuff, but it basically evolves around probabilities. So you know people are not telling the truth because you know by the laws of probability what would be a particular outcome. And then you kind of modify the costs of this or that there's very, very insightful work about that. It doesn't have a lot to do necessarily with controversial topics, but there's evidence that people really can be pretty dishonest in certain scenarios. Political science tends to go more on the population level, so out of the lab-based experiments, and a lot of the technique in List experiment was developed in political science, and they are particularly interesting controversial topics, often voting practices that have to do with certain attributes of a candidate. And so both of those, there is some lab-based aspects to this, but it's also experimental design that seeks to kind of alleviate the social desirability bias. Now, in political science, it's often seen as a measurement correction, so it's in a sense, when you alleviate the social desirability bias, you're getting at some sort of deeper inner truth. Sociology would be a bit more skeptical of that interpretation, but that's just disciplinary. All right, let's look at the next. In sociology, the item count technique or the list experiment we've done today is increasingly mainstream. I don't think that's necessarily broadly done, but the sensitivity to it has informed a lot of qualitative research, the kind of turtles all the way down approach. That informs when you start to know what's true in ethnography or what is worth sharing as an experience of those that you're interacting with. And stigma itself, that whole literature and stigma came from that more kind of interactionist qualitative approach, which has been very sensitive to the meaning of stigma and very skeptical of responses to kind of quick, direct questioning for a long time. And then in survey methodology, you see a lot of this, but it's mostly playing with the veracity of response and consistency of response. And list experiments are put in there, but there's also, you see, coming from social psychology, the use of implicit association tests, kind of statistical truth serum. And there's a lot of focus on wording and priming to kind of alleviate that. But there's a big concern across most of the main disciplines in social science. And so that's kind of where what informed what we did next. So can we move on?
Hi, I'm just going to drop in here for a second to talk a little bit about the Irish context and previous Irish research. I guess many of you will know Ireland has a long-standing history of emigration. Immigration is a feature of the last few decades and has brought increasing ethnic and national diversity. In terms of attitudes to immigration, an earlier report in this research program using European Social Survey data found that attitudes in Ireland were linked to educational attainment, financial stress, social contact. But we were a little bit skeptical, or I think the team was, that possibly some of the responses of the highly educated may have been linked to social desirability bias, which in part motivated this experiment. There's also a qualitative thesis done by Martina Byrne. She does in-depth interviews of 20 professionals and participant observation, finding this is a highly educated group, that there's a distancing in the public sphere and a problematizing, and that the private discussions are very different. I've also been involved in some studies of the experience of discrimination ethnicity and nationality in the Irish labour market. Philip O'Connell as well, some general sense that there's that there are attitudes out there that we possibly aren't always detecting. So then a quickly looking here at these populations living in Ireland, this is just data from the 2016 census. There's been a rapid increase in the size of both these groups, but it's from a very low base. On the right there, you can see that both groups by 2016 had about 60,000 people living in Ireland. Now the population is small, so that's around 1.4% of the population, the total population, but ethnicity slash race only was only measured in Ireland in the survey in 2006. Religion goes back a little longer, but numbers of the both the Black and Muslim population were very small. They tend to be very young populations, highly educated, and but with high unemployment. Matt.
Okay, so this is when Fran and I formed our super team. Because basically there was, I'd worked in many other contexts with efforts to try to mitigate this kind of downward pressure to not report intolerances. But I never really, it wasn't really clear how we could do this in Ireland. So we piggybacked on the Economic Sentiment Monitor, which is kind of an ongoing nationally representative monthly telephone survey. And telephone surveys are interesting. They're kind of a halfway point between fully digital interactions and in-person interviews, like the European Social Survey would use, like a household interview. So you can expect them to be less of a direct interaction, and that would perhaps mitigate already some of the concerns you might have about people matching expectations. It asks about a bunch of demographic information and people's views on the economic situation, which is the primary motivation for doing the survey itself. And then they gave kind of impoverished sociologists one question to add to the Economic Sentiment Monitor, which was lovely and was a start. But I think that both Fran and I would have liked to have done more perhaps. But this is a great place to go, and there really wasn't much of a tradition here in this, which explained why there was a lot of interest afterwards, because the insights this offer are interpreted in many different ways, which we can discuss later. So it was gathered in two waves, and by two waves, these are monthly waves. These aren't like every 3 years or something like that. So it was June and July that these were asked, and they were, I'll show you the design. So then we came up with a way of doing the design. So basically what you get is in the June sample, the question was asked about Black immigrants to Ireland. In July, we have Muslim. Basically what happens is you get this for the 812 respondents in June, there's a randomization into two groups here. So it's embedded into two waves. So you can click one more forward, I think, Fran. One more again. Okay, so it's embedded into two waves, and the first, it's randomized into two groups, and the first group gets a direct question and a control, what they call, refer to as the control list. And so the control list is you get this question that you see on the left of your screen, and that would be, they effectively are asking about a respondent to answer to how many questions or how many items they support in this single question. And you always say something like, I don't want to know which statements, just how many. And there's variations on this, but it's kind of crucial about these questions because you don't want people to answer all of them the same way. You want them to be some variation in how they respond so that they don't hit the floor or ceiling they refer to, meaning that if they agree with all of them, you know what their response is to any given one, and you want to kind of avoid that. So this control list, you're going to get a number, and that number is going to be between 0 and 3. And across this control group or this experimental group, you can estimate any statistic of central tendency, so a mean or a standard deviation or a median, anything like that. So click one more forward. To the same group, you also present a direct question. Now, there's a lot of ways to do this if you have a bigger sample, and this is there are some drawbacks to doing it this way, but you ask the direct question following the control list, And that is a question that you would find in a standard survey if you wanted to know directly a question about these two particular groups. The phrasing "people coming to live in Ireland" is derived from the European Social Survey because it was fairly road tested in that it doesn't necessarily use terminology like immigration, which can elicit particular types of responses. So it tends to be a pretty a certain way of asking that question. So anyways, from this particular group, you have this control list. So a given respondent, you have some number between 0 and 3, which is the number that they attribute to this control list of questions. And then you have the proportion that would agree or disagree with this direct question. So click forward one more time. The next group is this treatment list, which is down below, which is a randomized subset of the June sample or the July sample. And to this group, you present this an identical list question as you did to the control list, but there's what they refer to as a focal item that is placed in it as well. And the order of that item can be randomized. And basically what this does is, if you think about it, that's like an obnoxious way to put it. So basically what this does is it allows you to get an average response or a number across all respondents that you can average. That is how many of these four items now the respondent agrees with. Now, the average response to the three items in the control list, if you take that average and you subtract it from the average response to this treatment list, you can basically see the proportion that are indicating support for this one additional focal item, which was asked in June and July separately. So we can forward, Fran, one more time. And that kind of click again, I think.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Yeah, no worries. It's all these weird animations. So basically that allows you to estimate this what they refer to as the indirect or covert proportion who agree with this additional focal statement. And it's just a difference in means of the subtracting the control list from the treatment list. That is useful. And some research can stop there because they would be skeptical of the direct question, they'd be uninterested in it, and they would just consider this to be kind of a corrected measure of the proportion who would support or be in agreement with that focal item. But we can click forward one more time. Sorry, again.
Sorry.
Yeah, no worries, there's all these. And then again. So basically what you can do at this point, because you have this indirect measure, is then you can look to see if that indirect measure differs significantly from the direct measure. And what that allows you to do is kind of estimate the distance, or they refer to as the extent to which there's social desirability bias present. So instead of assuming that it needs correction, you can actually see the extent that this indirect measure differs from what you would get if you asked people directly. It's a very inefficient technique in some ways, because you can only get aggregate responses, and you definitely need samples of a certain size to estimate any subgroups, which we didn't have a lot of leeway there because these are relatively small samples for what we were trying to do. But it's we did have enough statistical power to contrast the overall groups and large subgroups with some conditions. So at the end of the day, what we have here is we've got a covert or an indirect measure. So that's proportion who agree agree with this focal item in reference to Black newcomers or Muslim newcomers to Ireland. And you've also got a comparison of that indirect measure, that covert measure, to a overt measure, which is the direct question that shows you whether the difference between those two is significant or substantive. So I think that might be it for the method. Is that right, Fran?
Yeah. Now I'm going to take over to present some of the results. So this is just as Matt was saying, the demographic groups. So these were questions, identifying questions that were asked of survey respondents anyway. So we didn't have any control over these. Remember, there's around 800 respondents in each of the June sample, which is shown in blue, and the July sample with the Muslim question is shown in yellow. So, for example, for the age, we just got two groups. The 50 plus cutoff gives us almost half of the sample. This had nothing to do with us wanting to be in the younger age group, but I appreciate that for that over 50 plus and under 50 isn't quite a a usual cutoff in survey research. Again, with educational qualifications, we split the sample into those with third level education and those with Leaving Cert, which is the upper secondary qualification in Ireland. And then we also, given previous findings on these attitudes, we had information on whether the respondents were experiencing financial stress. The survey didn't mention ethnicity or religion of respondents, and these aren't typically this data is typically not collected in surveys in Ireland. Nationality, Irish, non-Irish was mentioned, but the numbers are much too small to distinguish these. We can talk a little bit about what we also ran the results with a separate a sample that excluded these. There weren't very many differences. There were only 74 of them between the two. So now, just having a look first at the number of positive responses for the control groups and the treatment groups for each month. So as Matt mentioned, anonymity is lost if the respondent says 0 or 4 on the treatment list. Basically, they have no cover then. The idea behind these experiments is that you're giving people cover or anonymity so they can express socially undesirable preferences and not fear any that anybody will ever find out. So ceiling effects are would imply the top score. In this experiment, floor effects are actually more problematic because our question is framed in terms of support for these minority groups immigrated coming to Ireland, and the socially desirable answer is yes. So if you have a look there, the floor effects are really minimal. So we're reasonably confident that anyone who holds a negative attitude towards Black and Muslim immigration will be able to express this anonymously in this survey. So what did we find out? On this chart and on the remaining charts, we have blue for the June survey, that's attitudes to more Black people coming to Ireland, and yellow, the July survey, questions on more Muslim people coming to Ireland. And the bars represent the proportion of the sample who directly expressed support for either of the groups, and then the slightly darker blue and yellow bars are the results derived from the list. The social desire, the bias is which we're attributing to social desirability bias, is the difference between the two. This is presented on these and following charts as an arrow, and only presented if they're statistically significant. Here you see, for example, that while 2/3 of people support more Black people coming to Ireland when asked directly, this falls to just over half when people are given anonymity in the list experiment. And we find no such masking of attitudes to more Muslim people coming to Ireland. So actually looking at the anonymously expressed attitudes, they're rather similar for the two groups and in the two surveys. What about gender differences in support? This chart presents male and female responses to the two minority groups. So concealing negative attitudes varies between men and women, but it depends on the group in question. Looking at the blue bars here for attitudes towards more Black people coming to Ireland, 21% of men mask or conceal lack of support compared to 10% of women. But then if we look at attitudes to more Muslim people coming to Ireland, we find no significant difference in the in anonymously expressed and directly expressed attitudes for men, but quite a significant extent of masking. 20%, over one fifth of female respondents conceal a lack of support for more Muslim people coming to Ireland. So the differences between men and women in terms of attitudes and whether these are concealed is, let's just say, not straightforward. What about age differences now with these two large age groups, 50 and older and under 50s? So regarding support for Black immigration, there's more masking on the among younger respondents. You see there the arrow 18.6% mask compared to around 11% of that older cohort, and for Muslims, of course, there's overall much less masking towards negativity towards Muslim people coming to Ireland, but here too, it's among the younger group that we find it, and no evidence from this experiment of masking lack of support among the those aged 50 or older. In terms then of educational qualifications, I think it's always good to be somewhat surprised by research findings. That's part of the reason I'm in the game, and here. These findings were a surprise. I mean, we were expecting more masking of negative attitudes among the highly educated, and you can see that there, particularly in terms of Black immigration, 26.8% mask, and much smaller proportion of those with lower educational qualifications. Also, in terms of the Muslim question, more Muslim people coming to Ireland, we find masking among the highly educated, but not among those with lower education. So granted, these are just two large groups, but it does suggest that at least some of what we find in surveys of attitudes using direct questions, that highly educated are more favourable and supportive of immigration of these minority groups, that some of that is actually people hiding their intolerance in direct survey questions. We also looked at financial stress and support following previous findings in Ireland that those who were experiencing financial stress tended to be this is difficulty making ends meet, these sort of standard questions that they were less supportive of immigration. In terms of masking, I guess we didn't find such clear differences between those groups, and actually the extent of masking is rather similar, particularly compared to some of the other groups. Another way of kind of looking at it is, what's the story when you compare directly expressed attitudes in Ireland from the surveys? And here you find, you know, for example, certainly the direct questions in these surveys that men are more supportive of Black immigration than women, younger people are much more supportive than older people. The highly educated are again more supportive than those with upper secondary qualifications or below, and this is particularly the case for more black people coming to Ireland. And then, how does the story change when we look at the anonymously expressed attitudes, the list estimates? And here, actually, you see, well, I mean, firstly, in terms of the age, okay, so with regard to Black immigration, younger people, the under 50s, are still more supportive. But in terms of, say, attitudes to Muslim immigration, we find that women are much less supportive than men if we look at anonymously expressed attitudes, though that's not the picture we would have got from direct questions. And like I've just said, there's another illustration of how actually between these two groups, there's no significant differences. Actually, the levels of support are rather similar between the two groups. So, just in summary, takeaways, key takeaways from this lunchtime: attitudes are more positive towards Black immigrants and Muslim immigration, sorry, when expressed directly, but not when expressed anonymously. So we've got a something particular to Black immigration or to Muslim immigration. We can talk a little bit more about that in the discussion. On the direct questions, there's a large difference between those with third level education compared to upper secondary, but in anonymously expressed attitudes, we don't find such education differences, at least for the groups as defined. And as I've said as well, masking varies by gender, more prevalent among women when asked about Muslims. Women in Ireland are less supportive of Muslim immigration than men. What are the implications here? This is the kind of so what question. This report was for the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission, and part of the interest here was, you know, what can that tell us? What can we do? And here we argue in the report that, directly expressed attitudes still do matter. They're likely to influence public behaviour and also the public experience of minority groups. It's very different living in a society where there's open hostility to your group compared to where there's not. But these covert, anonymously expressed attitudes may matter more for what we term private actions. Voting is one example. One that I've been particularly interested in is recruitment. Also, letting property and experience of discrimination and recruitment, for example, is high for the Black ethnic group in Ireland. So this is a way of understanding how groups may be experiencing discrimination or have poorer outcomes, even though on the surface support for these groups may be high. Yes, as pointed out in that ethnographic thesis, decision makers, be they landlords or employers, HR managers, are likely to be highly educated. So what those findings for the effects of education are interesting here. I guess yes, it's a directly expressed opinions are important, but efforts may be needed to understand these more subtle forms of prejudice, you know, like, and if you're designing interventions, has any given intervention changed participants' anonymously expressed preferences or simply changed socially what's socially desirable to respond to? In terms of future research, possible and ongoing, there was an additional experiment fielded 2 years later in Ireland in 2019, which explored attitudes to EU origin immigration. That's immigration, not integration. So this is ongoing work, but analysis of these findings will form a kind of complement to the study. I'm sure you can think of many other applications, and indeed Matt knows some, but in Ireland, for example, these could be applied to social distance scales. Would you like a member of a minority group, a specific minority group, to be your neighbour, your colleague, a family member, or other social attitudes to Ireland, for example, on attitudes to abortion or gay rights? These experiments could also be added to international surveys like the ESS, or indeed investigate behaviour, discriminatory behaviour. Have you ever turned someone down? Or more recently, I've been involved in an illicit experiment of compliance with COVID-19 public health guidelines. This is ongoing work too, but it's, you know, the idea here is it's very socially desirable, perhaps for people to report that they have been keeping distance and wearing masks and washing their hands, but whether that's actually the case, they may be some of this may be affected by social desirability bias. Okay, I'll just say thanks for listening. I think that's more or less all from us here at this point. The full report is on the SRI website if you want to read any further. And there's also more information on the research program that this report's part of it. Other reports have looked at, as I said earlier, attitudes to diversity, ethnicity and nationality in the Irish labour market, discrimination and inequality in housing, disability and discrimination, caring and unpaid work, and some technical papers. Okay. Thanks for listening. Any questions or comments?
Thank you very much. That was absolutely fascinating. I'm sure there are lots of questions that people want to ask. Margaret Samayita, would you like to ask your question?
Perfect. Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi. Thanks for a really interesting presentation. So I'm an economist at UCD and I do a lot of survey experiments looking at people's attitudes towards different policies, including immigration. So I'm curious about two things. So first, do you think it's also a problem when looking at, when eliciting these desirable / undesirable attitudes using online surveys where people are anonymous? Have you seen any study looking at whether or not it's as much of a problem there? And second, I'm wondering in a meta way, whether or not knowledge about results from these kinds of list experiments and the fact that actual attitudes are not as desirable as the expressed attitudes will eventually lead the population to be more expressive of their actual attitudes, even if it's not as desirable.
Questions.
So I can answer the question about online engagement with and the veracity of responses. Like the innovation panel, which is a subset of kind of understanding society in the UK, list experiments done there, including ones that I've done, it don't show a dramatic difference of what you find when you do direct interaction. So people's hesitancy for some groups tends to be pretty consistent, including the response pattern that we see in Ireland for attitudes towards Muslims. Immigrants, which shows very little social desirability bias, is methodologically somewhat comforting in that you don't always find a social desirability bias. In other words, people's backstage and front stage attitudes tend to be quite consistent. That's true in the US, that's true in the UK, at least pre-Brexit. Post-Brexit, there's a social desirability gap that opens up. And in Ireland, it seems to be the case. Now, sociologists might differ, and some social psychologists as well, in the sense that indirectly or anonymously expressed opinions aren't more true. They're not necessarily interpretable that way. They're just a different context. And so people express things differently in that context. Some might say it's a measurement correction. I wouldn't fall into that camp, but I can understand why someone might say that. So I think that there is some work, there's some kind of more theoretical thought that goes into what anonymously expressed opinions mean. And I think Fran got it, that perhaps they mean in terms of behavior that they influence different domains more. So they might influence anonymous acts more than they influence overt acts. That might be one way. Fran, you want to answer the second question?
Yeah, thanks. Margaret, I Yeah, it's that's a tricky one. This experiment did generate quite a lot of public interest in Ireland when the report was published this summer. So I guess increasing awareness of this as an issue might go some way to getting people to reflect just a little bit more on what attitudes they hold and what attitudes they conceal. I think maybe a bigger point is, yes, sort of understanding this and the extent of this might help inform some targeted interventions, like, for example, you know, the education findings might suggest that maybe the information campaigns need to be throughout the population, not just targeted at those with lower education. That's just an example. But yes, I guess it would be interesting to know let's just say this sparked debate in Ireland.
Great, thank you so much.
So we've got Paul O'Connor wondering to what extent those groups that mask their lack of support are viewed or view themselves as societal gatekeepers. Says, I'm thinking of the decision makers, but also the female groups being Muslims. So I recall a series of attitudes to traveller surveys by McGrail, in which travellers were increasingly more welcome as family members, but with the question framed as having a traveller marry into a settled family, not vice versa. Sort of the institution of marriage as gatekeeping. So there's a question there about social gatekeeping, societal gatekeepers, and how these relate to the attitudes. Do you either of you want to say something about that?
Matt, you have any thoughts there?
I don't actually. I don't know. I don't know. I guess I don't really fully understand societal gatekeeping. What that implies, I guess that's referring to the actor or the respondent as taking on that role. I think this pretty limited question, it would be pretty far from the data to say that whether that's the case, but I don't have a lot of insight into the particular study reference there. Fran, do you know it?
The McGrail. Yes, I know that, I know his work on attitudes. There's been no list experiment, but in terms of attitudes to Irish travellers, I would say there wouldn't be quite so much certainly social desirability bias in responding. I'm not sure if I know that particular finding about it was that. People had more positive attitudes to travellers marrying settled people. Can I just hear that again? Yeah, I'm not sure I know that particular one.
So, I don't think we've got Paul able to speak here, but my understanding of the question is that it's trying to pick up this difference in attitudes of women to Muslims, so that they're much, anonymous, they're much more resistant. And so is this about... and I think it's relating it to the work around travellers in the sense that why is it that women are asking much more in relation to Muslims? So are they thinking about issues about who they're protecting or how they're...
The question about motives is a good one. It is interesting that you see in list experiments gender differences. In most direct questions about immigration, you see very little differences by the sex of the respondent. So you tend to pick up this more in social desirability. So differences in masking tend to be more pronounced. I don't know about the gatekeeper role, but there are arguments about what you refer to as kind of secular opposition versus kind of cultural threat arguments. So a sense of kind of arguments that are based in kind of either national identity based in religion, you can even fold ethnicity into that, kind of ethno-nationalism, versus a kind of broad concern about religion as a practice, so like a kind of more neutral opposition to religion as an orientation. So when you make that characteristic salient about an immigrant group, you're picking on this kind of like secular, often intertwined with broad support for gender equality and things like that, that tend to target particular outgroups. So you see it's very contested debate there about the implications, at what point you're picking up on kind of a rejection of Islam as a kind of targeted Islamophobic reaction, and whether you're targeting Islam as you would any religious group were they to come in, because there's a general resistance to religiosity, which is perhaps sounds nuanced, but is definitely, when you're thinking about mechanisms, quite different orientations in terms of the origin of that sentiment. Is that helpful, Lucinda, you think?
Yeah, I could just add, yes, I mean, I guess the evidence we have, we can't really say from this list experiment what's driving the more negative attitudes. In terms of just as a general background, listeners may also know this, social attitudes in general in Ireland have become much more progressive in the last kind of 20 years to gender roles, to gay rights. You maybe know the marriage referendum, and this is also social attitudinal context has changed. That's just as a background.
Yeah, I think there's some ways in which the findings raise more questions than they answer.
Yes, yes, indeed, yes.
Yes. Do we have some? Do we have anybody else who'd like to ask a question?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you for the presentation, and I have a question. So I understand that people usually hide their negative attitudes toward minorities, but I found in the result there are that male tends to hide their positive attitudes toward Muslim. So I'm really curious about what are the possible reasons for this. But, yeah.
So this is on the slide. Should I try and get back to the slide here?
Okay. I think it's slide 18. It's the male difference, the slide uptake, but it's not the difference. Oh, sorry, Fran.
No, that's fine. I'll just to show it up to point to. Yeah, let me get some sharing up here, just so people, in terms of people following. Let's see if this works. Is that sharing working? Have you got gender differences in support? Yeah. So yeah, as Matt was just about to say, this is correct. Actually, the anonymously expressed are somewhat more positive, but it's not statistically significant. So this is we attribute this to sampling variation. I guess it is possible, Matt. I don't know if you've encountered that in other experiments for. While one might expect there to be less support for minorities in anonymously expressed attitudes, it could be the case that people are more positive. Not quite sure.
Yeah, we haven't come across it too much, but there is a small literature on overstatement of certain positions among those that identify politically on the left or pertain to a party that would identify politically on the left, in a sense of wanting to match a position, a constellation of positions, and to be consistent, they might express tolerances or positive attitudes toward environmentalism, something that they don't actually, when asked anonymously or when they're decoupled from that larger constellation, might be different. I wouldn't fall in this category. If you play with list experiments, or do them, the anonymously expressed attitudes have very large confidence intervals around them because you're incorporating a number of forms of variation. So you have the variation in the response to the direct list question, the variation response to the indirect list question or the treatment question, and then the difference between those two is another source of variation. So you tend to have quite large intervals, which is why this technique is considered very inefficient. So don't read too much into differences like that. Only fairly large social desirability gaps are going to be picked up in a sample of this size.
Yeah, we didn't. An addition would be to add the confidence intervals. This was getting very busy then with the arrows here when we're trying to produce it all on one chart. But those confidence intervals would be big.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Yeah. I think we have another Another question, we have a question from Evelina Kristova. So her question is that you mentioned the attitudes differ by gender, age, education, among others. Do you have data on how they differ by region and or local communities? For example, influenced by immigration histories and share of immigrants locally. Are you planning to capture the overall exposure to immigrants in the social distance scale step beyond the contact on a personal level? So who would like to start?
Yeah.
Fran, maybe?
Yeah, good question. I guess in terms of the kind of overall regional experience of migration and these groups, I think certainly more, well, particularly these two minority groups would be much more likely to be living in the Greater Dublin area. Ireland is kind of fairly big geographically, but doesn't have a very large population. So, I think that there are definitely more of these particular groups in would be found in Dublin. A report we did last year suggested that in terms of concentration, this was migrants as a whole, there are some pockets, some electoral divisions in Ireland that have very high concentrations of migrants, but in general, those the indices, the segregation indices, don't show particularly strong concentrations of particular groups, migrant population is in general highly educated. They don't tend to live in disadvantaged groups. That's a sort of broad brush idea. Yes, it's a good idea, the notion of doing this a little more in particular neighbourhoods, and whether there's any difference between the role of social contact in both anonymously expressed and directly expressed attitudes. That is something we could think about looking. These surveys like this, that, as Matt said, we sort of piggybacked on, tend to be national surveys. So this is obviously a cheap way of doing this. And also, it's in the middle of a survey that's about something completely different, about people's saving behaviour and stuff. So there's no kind of, hopefully little in the way of priming effects, but they wouldn't have anything like the variation in terms of neighbourhoods. Some sort of urban rural perhaps would be worth looking into.
Great, thanks. Well, I think we've got Vicky Barry Brown who would like to ask a question, and then that's probably going to be our last question, unfortunately for today. So Vicky, do you want to ask your question?
Thank you. Hi, thanks for the presentation. It's really interesting. I'm researching English migration to Ireland since the 1960s and have ended up being mostly in the southwest due to coronavirus.
All right.
Yeah, largely concentration in West Cork, actually. And I'm aware, obviously, that English people in Ireland have been historically a much more common occurrence than the groups you're talking about here. And there's different complicating factors in all scenarios. I'm finding that often the English people who I've interviewed have felt more accepted by Irish people who've lived outside of Ireland or who have significant links outside of Ireland.
Yeah.
That's got me thinking, that's a factor that's not necessarily captured via this method, is it? Mm-hmm. But also, Fran, what you said about the financial situation, that had not occurred to me at all. And that's wonderful. And thank you so much for that's great. That's a path for me to explore. So.
I guess yes, if you could just as background for others here, a lot of adults in Ireland certainly over 30 would have some experience of having lived abroad, myself included, but it's actually very common, particularly having lived in the UK. And there's a lot of public discussion in Ireland about whether the experience at a sort of collective national level or even at an individual level, the experience of having been an immigrant themselves elsewhere has shaped the nature of the welcome. So that I think is an understanding that others may not share. I think that's very interesting what you're finding. I mean, there would probably be enough at a guess, I would say, even in a survey like this, to ask a simple question, have you lived outside the Republic of Ireland for a period of 1 year or more, or to sort of get a sense of that, which would be interesting. We don't have it on the European Social Survey, as far as I know, and Ireland doesn't do a lot of attitudinal research that's not either European or this kind of once-off surveys. There's not a sort of equivalent of the British Social Attitude Survey. We tend to rely on European data for that. So, but that is a good one, and it's also thanks, Vicky, for highlighting the fact that yes, that an important exception to the recent history of immigration is long-standing immigration of UK nationals to Ireland, and in contrast to say the Muslim groups and the black ethnic group in Ireland are much more concentrated along the western seaboard from sort of Cork to Donegal. So that suggests that their motives for migration may be somewhat different from those of many others.
That's great. Thank you so much.
So thank you very much to both of you. Matt, did you want to add anything as a final, any observation?
No. Nope. No, I would just detract from Fran's insight.
Yeah. So I think, that was really fascinating. I've got loads of questions which I might send you by email afterwards, but it's great to have you here. Thank you very much. And thank you for launching this new year of this seminar series.
Yeah, good luck with it, Lucinda. Thanks for having us.
Appreciate your time.
Great to see you.
Cheers. Bye.